along with the senator. The second attack was an effort to get me, personally, off their backs. They did it by going after my wife, and by the cold-blooded murder of an innocent man. Do you know about all of that? Yeah, I was told about it, and I read a newspaper story. Ritter put his jacket aside and stood up, looked around the room again, and Lucas said, "Sit back on the bed." And he did, but asked, "Why?" "Because if you have a hideout gun, it'll be harder for you to get at." Lucas had put the PPQ on the desktop, letting his hand rest a couple of inches away. "You're nervous." "Shouldn't I be?" Lucas asked. "Maybe, I guess." "The guys you're looking at, they're the real thing. They've all been over in the sandbox, both as military and as private contractors. If you get in their way, they'll flat put a hole in your head. But I'm not one of them." "That's comforting." Ritter looked down at his thighs, rubbed his nose, looked up, and said, "Look, a guy named Claxon, you're looking at him?" "Yes." "He told me you were probably the one who killed Jim, and he told me why. Your wife said Jim was waterboarded and then executed. That sounded funky to me. I should tell you that after I talked to Claxon, I cornered the medical examiner, and he said there was nothing to indicate that Jim had been waterboarded or tortured in any way, that nothing like that had been put in the autopsy report. But the report Claxon showed me specifically mentioned the waterboarding. I asked myself why that would be. Claxon wanted you to come after me. That's why I came up here empty-handed, no gun. I wanted to hear what you had to say." "Then you probably know who killed him," Lucas said. "And why?" "I'm not sure about the why. He wouldn't have talked." Lucas thought about it and said, "Because he'd become a problem. If your friends at Heracles are up to date, they'd know, and you probably now know, that we found some logs out in the countryside in West Virginia. They were used to protect the side of your brother's truck when they pushed Smalls's Cadillac off the road and almost over a bluff. If it had worked, it would have looked like Whitehead and Smalls accidentally ran off the road, hit a bunch of trees, and landed in the river. It's a fucking miracle that Smalls didn't die along with Whitehead. If he had, there would have been nobody to talk about a second vehicle." Ritter said, "You're saying it was a good plan, should have worked, but the targets caught a break." "Yes," Lucas said. "Their problem, your brother's problem, was we'd located his truck. You could see the damage where the logs had been tied to the side and some other forensic evidence that was convincing. If we got him for murder, and we were about to do that, maybe he'd give up the other people involved in return for leniency. We're more interested in those other people than we were in James, Jim. He was the trigger. He was paid. We want the people who hired him." "He wouldn't have given up anyone," Ritter said. "Jim was loyal to his pals, almost pathologically loyal. It was about all he had left after his time in the military and with Heracles. He'd gone to jail before he'd let a friend down, or died." "But would all of those people have known that?" "They are not the kind of people who think in those terms. Not people like Parrish or Claxon. They take care of themselves." "Claxon, if he had to make a choice between himself and his own kids, if he had any, his kids would be dead meat," Ritter said. Lucas poked a finger at him. "Exactly. Those are the guys we want." "We'll take the triggers, too, but they're not the ones who are driving this thing, the assassination attempt." "Do you know the other people involved in these actions?" "I think I do," Lucas said. "I think there were two more triggers, two more managers, and somebody who pulls the whole train." "Would that be Senator Grant from Minnesota?" Lucas tipped his head. "Where are you getting this?" "Like I said, I know these guys, and they know me and trust me. When I was fishing around, I heard all kinds of things. You couldn't take any of it to court. It's all rumor, but rumors from guys who are professional intelligence operators, and their rumors are better than most. There are some hints that if things work out, Heracles could have its own office at the White House. They looked at each other. Then Lucas took his hand away from the PPQ and rubbed the back of his neck and asked, "How far can I trust you? To hear what I have to say and not spread it around, even if it'll help you understand what happened to Jim." "I wouldn't tell a soul," Ritter said. "I mean that. Nobody would hear a word from me of what was said in this room." Lucas looked at him for a couple of beats, and Ritter added, "Look, I went to the academy. I'll be a general someday if I don't screw up, and so far I haven't. Jim didn't finish college, joined the army, took an entirely different path. He wound up with Delta. He was over there way too long, maybe killed too many people, including, you know, civilians, women, kids. His circle got too tight. He'd die for the people in the circle, but outside it, he didn't give a shit about anything. That pushed him out of the army. He killed one too many people who didn't actually need it. The army gets fussy about stuff like that."
"So he signed up with Heracles?"
"Yes. And he went right back to killing. I guess he was a bad guy in the end. But he was my brother. And he was close with the Heracles operators, the guys around him, and not the managers. If you told them to kill him, they were like Jim. They wouldn't do it. They might kill the guy who asked." Lucas shifted in the chair.
"That's interesting."
"Yeah?"
"Yes. I need to find somebody who knows what happened, or has a good idea about what happened, but would be loyal to Jim."
Ritter nodded. "Now tell me the truth. Did Senator Grant buy these hits?"
Lucas said, "I can't prove it, but I believe so. I believe she worked through Parrish, who is one of her aides and works with the Senate Intelligence Committee."
Ritter shook his head in disgust. "Parrish is tight with Claxon. I can give you names of people who can tell you that, if they decide to. People who work with Heracles but were close to Jim."
"That would be a great help if we ever get to a trial," Lucas said.
"Are you going to get Grant?"
"If somebody gives her up."
"That's the only way?"
"That's it," Lucas said.
"Well, shit." Ritter grunted, slapped his thighs, and said,
"I'm going to stand up now. I don't have a hideout gun, or whatever you cops call them. I'm leaving."
"Where are you going?"
"I'm in a BOQ over in Arlington, but I'm moving to a motel tomorrow. My parents got here from Nebraska this afternoon. They're falling apart. My father's mostly taking care of my mother. I'm trying to take care of both of them."
"I understand. Let me give you an email," Lucas said. "I need a secure email from you, if you have one."
"Of course I have one," Ritter said. "Not even the army knows about it."
When they'd exchanged emails and cell phone numbers, Lucas asked, "When will you be talking with your friends again, over at Heracles?"
"I'm going out to lunch with a couple of them tomorrow," Ritter said. "We're all talking about what happened to Jim. People are worried about Heracles and what's going on there. They're worried that if there's trouble, some of it will stick to them. Word is, some of them have already split, left the country."
"Will you call me if you hear something?" Lucas asked. "I don't know what your situation is over there. I don't want you to get hurt."
"I'm not ready to sign up as a spy. And I really don't want to talk to the FBI. I'm talking to you because in the stuff I read, those newspaper stories from Minnesota, you sounded like a guy I could deal with. If the FBI gets involved, if they detain me on suspicion of anything, I'm not going to get my stars. I'm not going to make colonel. My career will be over. So I've got to be careful. Lucas nodded, observing Ritter's escalating intensity. If these guys go after Smalls again, how would they do it?
I don't know. Ritter threw up his hands. They could do it a million different ways.
I know a SEAL who specialized in snatching Arab terrorists off their tea stools, hurting them bad enough that they couldn't resist or trigger a bomb hidden in a vest while the rest of his team covered him. He could put a man on the floor with broken bones in 2 seconds, literally, 2 seconds. I saw him do that. There are all kinds of techniques. They could run Smalls off the road again. They could break his neck and throw him down the stairs in his home. They could kill him with alcohol poisoning or an overdose, and never leave a mark on him. They all have some level of sniper training. Jim wasn't the best at it because, basically, he wasn't a sniper, but he could put a .338 through your chest at 1,000 meters if he had time to think about distances and angles and it wasn't too windy. There are guys at Heracles who are snipers, and they work at it all the time. They like sniping way better than sex. If you were sitting at a desk by a window, they could hit you from a mile out.
Okay, but be careful. If you hear anything operational, call me right away. I've got some hardcore guys here myself, and I can get more if I need them. He thought for a moment and added, if you hear any more about Jack Parrish, he could be Key, or John McCoy, or Kerry Moore, and Claxon, of course. I know those names, McCoy and Moore, from asking around.
They're the ones, huh?
Yep, I think so.
He almost told Ritter that 4 Heracles operators, including McCoy, had been arrested, but he didn't trust the man quite that much. Instead, he said, one more thing. Jim apparently had a girlfriend, or a girl he was friendly with anyway. Slender, very good shape. She knows how to get a rare concealable submachine gun, and knows how to use it and isn't afraid to. Looks to me like a pro.
What did she do? Ritter asked.
Lucas told him about the shooting in the hallway, and Ritter said, oh, geez, that was her? It's all over the news. They say nobody was hurt, though.
No, but she scared the shit out of quite a few people, including me.
I can't tell you much about her. I've met her once, and she didn't want to talk to me. I think she and Jim were in bed together, but she didn't want people to know it.
What's her name?
Ritter shook his head. She was introduced to me as just Susie. Jim seemed to like her, a lot, like marriage a lot. Made me happy, made me think we were getting him back, so I pried. I can't swear to any of this, but I believe she's covert CIA, the division called SAD SOG, Special Activities Division Special Operations Group, which is their paramilitary wing.
They have women working with them, combat types?
My understanding is they do. I know Susie spoke fluent Arabic. You know how cool that would be, a small woman speaking perfect Arabic, dressed in a niqab, with a gun in her underpants? She could go anywhere, and nobody would pay any attention to her. I suspect that's what she did, and maybe still does.
Tried hard to kill me, Lucas said.
Then you are a lucky man, Ritter said. Those folks don't miss much.
She had some bad intelligence, Lucas said, but it was goddamn close.
When Ritter was gone, Lucas got out his laptop and wrote a long report to Russell Fort about the interview, saved it, but didn't send it. Fort might be worried about possible illegalities being sheltered by the Marshal Service, and Lucas didn't want to get involved in that argument. Not yet. With the report saved, he settled back on the bed, dimmed the lights, and closed his eyes. There were several tangled thoughts stalking around his mind, and he needed to get straight with them. Tom Ritter had emphasized how dangerous the Heracles operators could be. He'd also talked about how loyal they were to each other, not so much to the managers, but to fellow operators. Yet something was going on. Jim Ritter had been killed and Kerry Moore had disappeared. Either Claxon, the guy with two loaded pistols on his desk, or Parrish could have killed them. Or, a new thought, so could have Taryn Grant. Grant might be unlikely, he thought after some consideration. Whoever killed Ritter picked him up and threw him in a dumpster, and Ritter, a muscular man, had probably weighed 180 pounds. Grant would have wanted to move him quickly out of a car and into the dumpster, but he was too heavy for one woman alone. Lucas doubted Grant would have exposed herself legally to direct involvement in a murder. And even if she had commissioned the killing, somebody else had probably carried it out. If you bought Tom Ritter's feelings about personal loyalty, the killer wouldn't have been McCoy or Moore. If it were neither of them, it would have been Parrish or Claxon, or perhaps some third party Lucas didn't know about yet. And here was the big problem. Whoever it had been, Lucas could see no clear route to implicate Taryn Grant. None of the major actors would see any benefit in selling her out. To do so, they would have to admit they had been conspirators in murder. Even that might not be enough to get her. Further, Grant's money would be available to fund the best possible legal defenses for her associates. If she had a real shot at the presidency, there was a possible pardon downstream for those associates, if worse came to worse. If what he feared came to pass, getting Taryn Grant might not be possible. Not in the ordinary way. 24. Jane Chase called the next morning as Lucas was shaving. We're going to arrest Claxon this morning. Between the documents and what we'll get from McCoy, we can arrest him on several counts of illegal trading of restricted weaponry. That will take care of the statute of limitations problem. We've got search warrants for both his businesses and his home. Lucas, what did you give McCoy? Nothing at this point. Bunch showed up early this morning. It's early this morning right now, Lucas objected. Chase said, Lucas, it's 10 o'clock. I've been here since 6. Anyway, Bunch spent an hour talking with McCoy. When he was done, Bunch suggested to one of our attorneys, a DOJ guy, that McCoy could provide detailed information about various weapons shipments and that he got specific and possibly illegal delivery instructions from Claxon himself. Then what are you going to give him? Chase hesitated and said, Bunch is looking for immunity for any possible crimes deriving from involvement with employment with Heracles, Flamma, or Intercore Ballistics. Well, Jesus, Jane, that could mean involvement in the attack on Senator Smalls and all the subsequent murders, Lucas said. You know how Smalls is going to take that. He'll go on the Senate floor and he'll have a crucifix and nails with him and you'll be the one nailed to the cross. Well, McCoy denies any involvement with the murders. Bunch says those can be attributed to Ritter and persons unknown. Frankly, Lucas, with what you've developed so far, no prosecutor I know would try McCoy for murder. Claxon won't admit to knowing anything about the murders. Ritter's dead and more... We don't know. He may be dead as well.
So McCoy walks?
He won't walk. We've got him on the weapons stuff with or without any additional testimony. He'll do time. We're going to tell Bunch that we want between 10 and 15 years on the weapons charges. He won't take that, but he'll take 5. McCoy'll only get that if he hangs Claxon. Otherwise, we take him to trial and ask for 15.
Lucas said, Then you've got to go after Claxon hard. You've got to talk about a deal to implicate Parrish and Grant.
He won't take a deal, Chase said. He'll go to trial and hope to beat it. If he doesn't and can't win on appeal, he'll try to deal on the sentence. You've said it yourself. The only way he could implicate Grant would be to admit that he set up at least 2 murders and maybe 3. He won't do that. It will be hard enough to get him on the weapons. He'll try to drag in CIA and military operators for the defense, and they'll resist on grounds of national security.
Ah, shit, Lucas said. Chase waited him out, and Lucas finally asked, What are you doing today, other than arresting him?
The searches. You and your team are welcome to observe, Chase said. We'll be at McCoy's townhouse and Heracles and Claxon's office, grabbing files, and Claxon's house. The warrants are in hand. We've got teams on the way. I'll probably go to Claxon's house to get a feel for what he's like.
I'll tell you what he's like. He keeps 2 loaded automatic pistols on his office desk.
Doesn't surprise me.
Remember what I said about Smalls and the crucifix?
It won't be me that he goes after. It's the Attorney General who'll be fronting this, and I doubt that Smalls would take her on.
Lucas said, Give me Claxon's address. Claxon lived off the heavily wooded Kurtz Road in McLean, Virginia. The house was a stark, red-brick 3-story structure that sat back on a large lot 10 or 15 feet above street level. There was a 2-door double-car garage at the end of the blacktopped driveway and 2 stone pillars at the front door. 4 SUVs crowded the driveway, and a man with the air of a junior FBI agent leaned against one of them, smoking a cigarette.
"Mr. Kurtz, he dead,"
Lucas quoted as he rolled by, looking for a place to park.
"I know that," Ray said. "Heart of Darkness. I'm surprised you know it, being, you know, a hockey puck. Actually, it's from The Hollow Men by T.S. Eliot," Lucas said. "This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper."
"Bullshit," said Ray. "Heart of Darkness."
"Nope. Hollow Men."
"Jesus, now I got to look it up," Bob said. He took his phone out and started typing with his thumbs. There wasn't enough space to park in the driveway, so Lucas found a place a couple of 100 feet down the street where he could pull all 4 wheels off the pavement. As they got out of the truck, Bob said,
"Ah, got it."
"Who wins?" Ray asked.
"I do," Lucas said. "I know the whole poem.
And I know the whole Joseph Conrad novel practically by heart," Ray said. Bob said, "You're both right. Conrad wrote it. Eliot quoted it as the first line of his poem."
"I was right first," Ray said.
"Eliot's poem is far better known," Lucas said. Bob said,
"Shut the fuck up, both of you. We're cops, not some literary, you know, fairies."
"Well, I'm not, anyway," Ray said. "Lucas is the one who quoted the fruity poem." The cigarette smoker was field-stripping his Marlboro as they walked up the driveway, and he snapped the filter into a hydrangea bush.
"This is an FBI undertaking," he said, carefully checking them out. "I suspect you know that."
"U.S. Marshals," Lucas said. "Jane Chase should have cleared us through. If you're Davenport, Matisse, and Givens, she did." He looked at his watch. "She should be here in the next few minutes." The impression Lucas had of Claxon's house was rugs and cigars. A thin odor of smoke hung in the entry hall like a signal of masculinity. A 12 oriental carpets in a variety of sizes spotted the russet-colored plank floors like high-dollar islands. The place had been done by a decorator, apparently told to make it into a British men's club, with everything but spittoons.
Wooden boxes, Bob said, and when Lucas looked around, he noticed lots of antique boxes.
And mirrors, Ray said. There were a dozen FBI agents inside the house, slowly taking it apart. They were mostly looking for documents, but hadn't had much luck. A bureau locksmith had failed to open a wall safe in the study. The house naturally had a study, two walls of bookcases, an oil portrait of a woman on a third wall, and the requisite cut-stone fireplace on the fourth. The safe was hidden in one side of the fireplace. A tech bypassed the password on a Dell computer, but except for routine business docs, more bank statements, all documents were encrypted, everything else cleaned out by the same Windex program that they'd found on Ritter's desktop. They'd taken Claxon's iPhone when they arrested him, and now they found a second phone in one of the many wooden boxes. The same tech said,
"The phones are locked. No can go there. Six digits, four chances, a million possibilities."
One of the agents told Lucas, "He's like the Ritter guy. He's got a safe deposit box somewhere under a false identity with all the good stuff." Bob said, "We found Ritter's safe deposit keys in the sink trap in the bathroom."
"Already looked there," the agent said.
An agent clumped up the basement stairs holding four black rifles by their slings. Ray asked, "Full auto?" "These are," the agent said. "He's got seven gun safes down there, 35 rifles of various kinds, 22 pistols."
"He's an arms dealer," Lucas said. "He'll have got permits for everything."
Chase showed up a few minutes later, got a quick briefing from the agent heading up the search. To Lucas, she said, "Not much at his business, either. They were careful about documents. I suspect that the stuff we got from Ritter was emailed to him as encrypted documents, but after decrypting, Ritter broke security and printed it instead of wiping it clean and hid it as insurance." Lucas said, "We talked to Claxon's PA when we went to his office the first time. Older woman, maybe ready to retire. Any chance of getting her here?"
"What for?"
"So Bob, Ray, and I can intimidate her. Bet she knows his phone code." Chase gazed at Lucas, said,
"We have her. Haven't arrested her, but we've detained her. I could bring her here to answer questions about his lifestyle and so on. She's already intimidated."
"Park her in the parlor. Let her sweat, and then we'll drop in on her."
"I'll make the call," Chase said.
The PA's name was Helen Oakes. Lucas, standing at a front window, watched her walking up the driveway two steps ahead of her FBI escort. She was wearing a conservative gray suit, and he remembered that she was wearing gray the first time they'd seen her. Not a woman given to flamboyance. Bob and Ray were watching an FBI search team guy rolling up rugs, and Lucas called to them,
"She's here. Let's get out of sight."
They hurried into the study, and Chase met Oakes at the front door and took her to the living room. Ray told Lucas what she had learned about Claxon's rugs.
"They're okay, not great. Most of them made in India. The rug guy told me they look better than they actually are."
They were still talking about the rugs, and the guns and the mirrors and the antique boxes, and the two Japanese swords racked near the door, when, 10 minutes later, Chase poked her head in the room and said,
"I worry about this, so go easy as you can."
Lucas nodded.
"Sure."
When Lucas, Bob, and Ray walked into the parlor, Oakes was seated on a beige, Italian-looking couch, knees tight together, elbows tight to the ribs, purse in her lap, held with both hands. She was frightened. Ray dropped on the couch beside her, a few inches too close.
"Ouch!" she exclaimed, reaching under her jacket and pulling out her Glock.
She leaned across Oaks and, with noisy clatter, dropped it on the end table, its muzzle pointing toward Oaks. To Oaks, she said,
"Shit gets up my back. Know what I'm saying?"
It wasn't a real question, and Oaks didn't answer. Lucas took a chair facing her, and Bob dragged over another chair, its legs scraping across the plank floor with a tooth-rattling screech, until he was also too close to her. Lucas said,
"Ms. Oaks."
Bob,
"Jesus, Lucas, call her Helen. We're all friends here. That is your name, right? Helen?"
Oaks nodded, flinching away from Bob. Lucas said,
"Okay, Helen. Look, we don't want to frighten you, and you're not required to tell us anything. We won't arrest you at this point, but you are in serious jeopardy."
"That's the fucking truth," Ray said. "He ain't bullshitting you, babe. Excuse the language."
"Everybody shut up," Lucas said. "I'm talking."
"Yes, boss. I always do what white people tell me," Ray said.
"Shut the fuck up, both of you, and let Helen talk," Bob said.
Lucas continued, "Helen, your boss is going to prison for a very long time, probably for a couple of decades or more if we get him for these murders. I'll be honest and tell you we aren't all that interested in you. You're small fry. We're interested in Claxon and some of his military operators. If you stonewall us and we give up on you, we could easily throw you in the same bag. We know you must have had intimate knowledge of what was going on in there, since you're so close to Claxon."
"I was his PA,"
Oaks wailed, opening her mouth for the first time.
"I handled his schedule and travel reservations, but I didn't do any of the business stuff."
"Oh, horseshit," Ray said.
Lucas snapped, "Ray, I don't want to have to warn you again."
"You ain't warned me the first time, cracker," Ray said.
To Oaks, she said, "I can tell you from personal experience, honey, that you don't want to fuck with the FBI. Those cold-hearted motherfuckers drop you in a hole without thinking about it twice, and not even remember you're there after they throw you in. Claxon's going down for 30. You don't want to be in that bag."
"Come on, Ray," Bob said. "Don't be trying to scare her."
To Oaks, he said, "Even if they put you in prison, well, federal prison, especially for women, isn't that bad. You get 3 hots and a cot and good medical attention."
"Not the only kind of attention she'd get," Ray said, lifting her eyebrows. "Some of them rug munchers can get right up on your lap."
"Come on, Ray, goddammit," Bob said. Lucas raised his voice.
"Again, everybody shut up."
To Oaks, "Claxon's computers are all encrypted. Do you know his private key?"
"No, I don't."
"Nobody knows that but him.
It's long. I've seen him entering it on his computer, moving his lips when he's doing it. It's like he's typing in whole words, and he's not referring to anything. He's got it memorized."
"That's bad," Ray said. "Is everything in code?"
"Most everything," Oakes said. "That's why I don't know anything. It all goes back and forth in code because it's mostly classified. I know they ship armaments from one place to another, but all these details are in code. That's not what I do."
"You do his travel," Lucas said. "Did you arrange his airplane flight to Omaha?" She hesitated, then said,
"I knew he was flying."
"Do you know who was with him?" The hesitation again.
"No, but I got 4 box lunches. I have no idea who they were for, but one of them could have been Carol."
Lucas, Bob, and Ray all glanced at one another. "Who's Carol?" Lucas asked. "Is that a woman?" She nodded.
"Carol Ruiz. I don't know that she went, but she was buzzing around that day before George, Mr. Claxon, left. We don't see her very often. She doesn't work for us, so I don't know that much about her."
"Are they intimate?" Bob asked. "George and Carol?"
Oakes frowned, repeated,
intimate?
You know, Ray said, is George slipping her the pink piccolo, the old skin flute?
Oh, no. No, Carol mostly talks to the guys. I think she's an OGA.
Lucas, she's a spook?
Careful where you go with that, Ray said to Lucas. I don't like that spook shit.
She glared at Oakes, leaned into her. You don't never say spook, do you?
I never,
Lucas said.
Hmph. Carol Ruiz. We'll take a look at her. Don't mention my name, please. She's scary.
We'll try not to, Lucas said. He took his notebook and a pen from his jacket pocket, flipped the notebook open, wrote, Carol Ruiz.
Can you tell me what she looks like?
Oakes said.
She's shorter than I am, and I'm 5'6". She's thin, like a marathon runner or something. That's what she looks like. Black hair, dark eyes. Doesn't laugh much. In my opinion, she's not quite right. She looks at you funny. Please don't tell her I gave you her name.
If we have to use your name, we'll make sure Ruiz knows you're protected by the FBI, Lucas said. To get back to Claxon, I understand that his encryption code is a long one, but his phone code wouldn't be. Either 4 or 6 numbers, right? You must know what that is. She began to cry. Lucas let her go for 15 seconds, then said, Helen, don't lie to me. You can tell me that you refuse to answer, but you can't lie to me. That's a crime, and I'm not lying when I say that.
He does lie a lot, but not about this stuff, Ray said.
Please don't tell him,
she said, and sobbed again. We'll do the best we can to keep it private.
It's 312415.
Lucas wrote it in his notebook as she recited it.
How'd you figure it out? Ray asked.
I sit beside him when we're in a car. I've seen him do it 100 times, and I just remember it. He didn't try to hide it, because it's like I'm not there most of the time.
Lucas stood up. We'll need you to wait here, Lucas said. Your escort will come pick you up.
Please don't tell George I told that to you. I'm afraid of him.
Like Carol Ruiz, Bob said.
Well, Carol's different. Carol's crazy. George is only mean. You can deal with mean. You can't deal with crazy.
Lucas stepped out of the parlor and into the hallway, and Chase, who was standing there, listening out of sight, said, Mr. Claxon isn't the only one who can be mean. Lucas said, There are 3 people dead that we know of, and maybe 4 if Moore was killed. We weren't even mean enough to give her bad dreams. Let's go try the phones. The FBI tech had bagged the iPhone in transparent plastic. He left it in the bag when he turned it on. Chase read the number from Lucas's notebook, the tech punched it in, and the phone opened up. We need printouts of everything, she said to the tech. Like now.
Yes, ma'am, he said. What about the other phone?
Maybe he only has 1 code to remember, Chase said.
The tech shrugged, got the bag with the second phone, and tried the code. The second phone opened up. Chase said to Lucas,
It was still mean, but I forgive you.
She walked away to talk to somebody else, and Lucas said to Bob and Ray, Carol Ruiz sounds a lot like Susie, who shot up the hotel.
She does, Bob said. But is it Carol or Susie?
25. Grant was walking a California venture capitalist through the Senate office building when Parrish called her. The VC was wearing an antique Black Sabbath t-shirt, black jeans, and a black linen jacket, and, at the back of his scalp, a small but prescient pink spot.
Grant expected that the next time she saw him, he'd have a shaved head. He had the rattlesnake charm of the typical VC, plus money and connections. The connections were the important thing. She was building her network, and if the presidential primaries came down to California, she needed them. The call from Parrish was an irritant. She told the VC, "One second, I have to take this," and she stepped away from him. "What?" she snapped into the phone. "We've got a problem with the subcommittee," Parrish said. "We need to talk in a secure facility." Emergency code. The subcommittee was Heracles and Claxon and the operators. "I can do it at noon," she said. "Meet me at my hideaway. Sooner would be better." "How long will the meeting be?" she asked. 15 minutes. "I can give you 15 at 10:30, she said. "I'm scheduled at 11. "See you then," Parrish said, and hung up. Grant reached out and put her hand on the VC's arm, turned him back toward her office, leaving her hand on his arm as they walked. She would fuck him, if necessary. "You know the problem with the Senate. It's like being nibbled to death by ducks. There's never a second during the whole darn day that somebody doesn't want to talk to you, and, most of the time, doesn't need to. People want to talk to you so they can say, 'I was talking to Senator Grant yesterday,' and then they start lying." The VC nodded. "I get the same thing. Some guy running a two-bit startup wants to say he talked to you so he can spread the word that there might be some interest in whatever he's peddling. Nibbled to death by ducks. I'll remember that." U.S. senators are each assigned hideaways in the Capitol, unseen by the public or the press. Only the senator has a key to his or her retreat, which are routinely checked for electronic surveillance. Not as secure as Grant's skiff, but close. Since Grant was a junior senator, her hideaway was in the Capitol basement, a windowless room barely large enough for a desk with a computer on it, an office chair, two wooden visitors' chairs, a work table, and a small office refrigerator. If she lasted for another term and got lucky with senatorial turnover, she might actually get a place with a window. Of course, if everything worked out right, she'd have a big oval-shaped office before that happened. Grant asked, "What happened?" as she dropped into her chair. Parrish took one of the wooden chairs. "The FBI hit Heracles this morning." "Ah, shit." "They detained Claxon." Claxon didn't say anything, asked to speak privately to his lawyer. They said he could, from his skiff. He did that, and he called me, all of it on our burners, but we ran his burner through a shredder so we should be clear there, Parrish said. "He could talk only for a couple of minutes, but what I get is the feds found Ritter's safe deposit box and took out a bunch of documents about some irregular weapons deliveries. Nothing to do with us, not directly. Since it was Ritter, I expect your friend Davenport is out there stirring up trouble." Grant pointed a finger at Parrish. But, what if it's Davenport trying to turn Claxon on the Smalls thing?" That was the second thing that occurred to me. The first thing was worse? "Well, I've been involved in some of Claxon's sales. It was a while back, but I was either already working for you or about to start working for you." "Ah, wait. I don't know that any of the documents involve those transactions. They might, but that would be purely unlucky. Still, I thought you should know about it, and that Claxon's been arrested. If Davenport's trying to turn him..." "Would McCoy or Moore be willing to solve that problem, the Claxon problem?" Parrish was shaking his head. "I can't find either of them. I asked Claxon, and he said Moore dropped out of sight yesterday or the day before. He may be on the run. McCoy is still around, or was yesterday afternoon, but nobody's been in touch with him since then. I cruised by his townhouse, didn't see anything unusual, but I didn't see his car either. He may have been picked up, or, like I said, he may be running.
Coming apart, Grant said. The whole deal's coming apart. How much do Moore and McCoy know about me?
Nothing more than your name, Parrish said. Basically, they know I work for you and that I'm friends with Claxon. And I don't care what Davenport suspects. As long as Claxon keeps his mouth shut, they can't get me. And if they can't get me, you're fine, too.
I'm not fine, she said. I'm in trouble here. I mean, if the FBI has Claxon on illegal weapons deals, it's possible that they could even get him on murder charges, depending on where those guns went. If they went to Boko Haram, God help us. Especially if they can get some of his operators to testify against him. Claxon might desperately need someone to deal. That would be you and me. Actually, it'd be me. I'm the big fish.
They stared at each other, and Paris said, So?
Your sources may decide you're toxic. Before that happens, you have to find out what's happening with Claxon, specifically what the feds have got on him, if he's in jail or going to jail, all of that.
Paris said, I already made some calls. I'm friendly with Claxon's PA. I'll catch her somewhere this afternoon and find out what she knows. And she usually knows everything that's going on in that company.
Careful, Grant said. She's an obvious source for the FBI as well. You might be talking to her and find out she's wearing a wire or something. Maybe under surveillance.
I can handle it, Paris said.
Another 10 seconds of silence. Then Grant asked, If Claxon has to go away, could you handle it?
I was afraid you'd ask that, Parrish said. I'll do some research. I've been over to his place. It's over in McLean, any number of times. There's woods behind his house, and he likes to barbecue on his back porch, and he likes to sit out there and drink. If the worst happens, are you good enough for that?
The shooting wouldn't be a problem. The getaway might be. Like I said, I'd have to do some research.
You'd better do the research, Grant said. Don't move without signaling me, but do the research.
When Parrish was gone, Grant worked through it and realized that if Claxon was going down, Parrish probably would as well. Parrish had worked with Claxon on several deals involving army procurement and major weapons deliveries. Like Claxon, Parrish would be looking for somebody to deal, and he only had one choice likely to clear him out of a prison term, Senator Taryn Grant. She walked back through the Capitol to her official office, brooding about it. She had 20 staffers in Washington, 20 more in Minnesota, and one of her Minnesota people was in town to brief her about a series of polls taken in the past 2 weeks on rural issues. She wanted to think, but she didn't want to break her schedule either, didn't want to appear in any way disturbed. She took the meeting. Numbers and more numbers, and all the numbers said that she was still strong in Minnesota, despite Smalls's efforts to screw her. They'd come to the question-and-answer segment when her chief of staff stepped into the room, leaned over her, and whispered, Jack needs just a moment. He's in your office.
Let's take a break, she told the polling group. 5 minutes.
In Grant's office, Parrish handed her a piece of notebook paper on which he had written, Claxon will be held overnight, but will ask for bail tomorrow, and he's expected to get it. She nodded and wrote a note back. We need a way to get face-to-face at a secure site and work this out. Not my skiff. I don't want him near my house. Someplace the cops won't have bugged. When he'd read the note, she took both pieces of paper and pushed them into her shredder.
26. Claxon's phones held only one gift. The iPhone, basically, was a long list of phone contacts, but with nothing recorded from recent calls, the phone was apparently wiped clean after each call, other than the list. Chase pointed out the one-button app for that.
"Lots of politicians have that app," she said.
The phone wasn't in Claxon's name. It was registered to a Gerald D. Wilson. The second phone, an off-brand burner, didn't have that app. On the day after Claxon admitted flying to Omaha, he made two calls and received two calls, all on the same anonymous T-Mobile burner phone. With the phone numbers in hand, Chase jacked up the FBI phone experts. A half hour after they'd opened the phones, she told Lucas that one of the calls was to Clear Lake, Iowa. Two more were from and to St. Paul, and the final one went through a tower west of Des Moines.
"That's when they hit weather and last," Lucas said. "Clear Lake is on the Iowa border, right off I-35, on the fastest route to the Twin Cities from Omaha. The last one was on I-80 on the way back to Omaha. That ties him directly to a murder."
"But doesn't prove it, unfortunately," Chase said.
"Oakes made four lunchboxes for the flight out," Bob said. "That's Claxon, Ritter, McCoy, and Moore."
"Unless one of them was Susie or Carol Ruiz," Lucas said. He turned to Chase.
"We need to ask McCoy who Susie is, or Carol Ruiz, and if they're the same person."
"We don't have a deal yet, but he's been giving up that kind of information, filling in the employee list."
"She might not be an employee," Ray said.
"We'll ask," Chase said. "I'll make a call."
"Let me in to talk with him," Lucas said.
McCoy was delivered to an interview room in the Hoover Building from an Arlington lockup at the insistence of both Chase and Bunch, McCoy's lawyer, a happy confluence of requirements. He was escorted by two marshals. One of them recognized Ray from a training program and asked,
"You guys are running an investigation? How'd that happen?"
She nodded at Lucas and said,
"Political pull. It's corrupt, but we fly business class."
"Are you shitting me?"
Bunch and McCoy were locked up to talk privately for a few minutes, and when they were done, Lucas, Chase, and a Department of Justice prosecutor named Steve Lapham went in, along with the two marshals. Lapham told Bunch, "We have a number of questions for both you and Mr. McCoy regarding arrangements for testimony. But before that, Marshal Davenport has a question for Mr. McCoy that has no potential legal liability for Mr. McCoy, as far as we know." Bunch said, "Ask. We'll decide whether he should answer." Lucas asked McCoy, "Do you know or have you seen a woman known either as Susie or Carol Ruiz?" He described her, and McCoy said,
"I've seen a woman who George called Carol who looks like that, but I don't think that's her real name. I think it's fake, and somebody told me she's a knock, a chick with a non-official cover working for the CIA or somebody else, I don't know who."
Bob asked, "You think she'd know where to get a silenced submachine gun?" McCoy shook his head.
"I don't know. I might be able to, but I'd have to dig around for a while, and I'm not sure I could. I was more of a meat and potatoes, M16 kind of guy."
Ray asked, "Would this chick have been hanging out with Jim Ritter?" McCoy thought for a minute, said,
"Yes, she did. I think they were, what do you call it, an item? For a long time. Jim said she was a girl he could trust. I saw them once over at the Last Minute Grill by the airport. I didn't interrupt. I figured Jim was flying out. They were saying goodbye, but I was wrong. She was the one flying out, and they might have been worried the way they were holding on to each other."
Lucas said, "Huh."
"I'll tell you one other thing,"
McCoy began, but Bunch put a hand on his arm and asked, "You're sure?"
"Shouldn't be a problem," McCoy said. "Maybe get a few more brownie points. I speak some Arabic. She speaks perfect Arabic. The one time I saw her at Heracles, she was talking to this Syrian guy like they were old friends, and I'm telling you, I thought she was Syrian."
Lucas had nothing more to ask, but he said to McCoy, "We've tracked the phone that Claxon used to call you boys on your way into the Twin Cities to hit my wife and murder Last. If I were you, I would sign anything that Mr. Lapham gives you, because if you don't, you're looking at 30 years in Stillwater Penitentiary after the feds get done with you." McCoy gave him a sullen look, shuffled his feet, and said, "You ain't from the Chamber of Commerce, huh?" They were getting toward dinner time, and Lucas, Bob, and Ray went back to the hotel, agreed to work out for a while and go to dinner together. When he was back in his room, Lucas called the number that Tom Ritter had given him.
"Marshal Davenport, I've only got a minute. We're filling out papers to get Jim buried at Arlington. Lots of paperwork. It takes forever. I'm calling about Jim's girlfriend, Susie. I'm now told that she might also go under the name of Carol Ruiz, and she might work for the CIA or some other agency and speaks perfect Arabic. Does that still sound like her?"
"Maybe," Ritter said after a bit. "I only saw her that one time. We were at a party, all military or ex-military people who worked in the Middle East. Jim invited me to come along. I didn't hear Susie speak Arabic, but there was a minute where a couple of guys were speaking Arabic, and she suddenly looked at them, and I got the impression she knew what they were talking about."
"Know where I could find her?" Lucas asked. "I need to talk."
"No, I don't," Ritter said. "I could ask around."
"I'd appreciate it. She's been seen at Heracles, so people there know her."
"All right, I'll ask. Should I give her your phone number?"
"Yes. I was on the wrong end of that submachine gun, so she probably wouldn't want to meet me at McDonald's."
"Why do you want to talk?"
"I want to find out if she was hired to shoot me up, or if she did it because she bought Claxon's line of bullshit about me torturing and shooting Jim. If she tried to kill me because she loved Jim."
"I'd like to know that answer myself," Ritter said. "I'll start making some calls."
After dinner, Bob needed to catch up with people on the Internet, and Lucas and Ray got Lucas's car and drove across the river to a Barnes & Noble bookstore they'd seen while driving around Arlington.
"I'm getting tired of the net," Lucas said as they crossed the river. "You can't separate the facts from the bullshit anymore. The constant carping drives me nuts. Did I ever tell you that I supervised the construction of our house?"
"Never did," Ray said.
"Well, I did, and it was interesting," Lucas said. "Sometimes I wish I'd become an architect. I used to go out on the net for tips on this one particular building site. I still check it sometimes. The last time I looked, there was this flame war about politics. At a construction site, I mean, why? Is there a difference between a left-wing and right-wing 2x4? I made the mistake, commenting on a story on the Wall Street Journal site, of mentioning that I'm black," Ray said. "I start getting that you people shit. Can't avoid it."
The bookstore was located in a California-style outdoor shopping center. After they parked, they got cups of coffee at Starbucks and split up to look at books. Since he was living in Washington temporarily, Lucas browsed the politics section and wound up with Dark Money by Jane Mayer, then hit the magazine rack while he waited for Ray to finish browsing. They were back at the Watergate by 9 o'clock. Lucas had finished the Hyacin book and set it aside to ship home, and had started the Mayer when the call came in from an unknown number. A woman with a light soprano voice.
"This is Wendy."
"Wendy who?"
"Susie, Carol, what do you want?"
"I didn't shoot Jim Ritter," Lucas said.
"Then who did?"
The question was as much a confession that she was the hotel shooter as he was likely to get, Lucas thought. She continued,
"Don't bother scrambling your tech, guys. I'm talking to you on an old burner. I'll throw it in the garbage as soon as I take the battery out."
"I understand that you're one of